During World War II, few countries experienced hunger more acutely than the Soviet Union. But even though food was scarce, the people on the home front made do as best they could by making dishes like this kasha, or porridge, made with millet and pumpkin. So thank you to Bombas for sponsoring this video as we try to survive on the Soviet home front, this time on Tasting History. Last month, I kicked off this series of home front cooking during World War II with the United States, where the home front and the war front were very much separate. But today, we're going to be talking about the Soviet Union, where the war front and the home front were very often the same place. Now, shortly before the war in Europe began, Germany and the Soviet Union had signed the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, agreeing that neither country would attack the other while they carved up the smaller countries between them. But then, on June 22, 1941, Germany and other Axis powers invaded the Soviet Union along an 1,800-mile front. And as it was a surprise attack, the Soviet Red Army was rather unprepared and took heavy losses, especially in that very first month. And so too did the Soviet people. Even if they were not right in the direct line of German panzers, they felt the effects of the invasion right away, most keenly in their stomachs. Within a month, Soviet citizens received their first ration cards, and from the start, rations were pretty meager. And we'll talk about just how meager they were, but before we do that, I wanted to find a recipe that kind of typifies what somebody might be eating at the time. The problem is that unlike most of the other countries I'm going to cover in this series, there were very, very few cookbooks being published in and around Russia at the time, and that was kind of on purpose. See, during the previous decades, there had been a push to liberate women from what they called kitchen slavery. That is, they shouldn't have to spend all day cooking, so they could work outside of the home. There was also an early idea of Bolshevism that relied on kind of an ascetic lifestyle, and this led food to change and become more simplified, and this led to few recipes being written down. Well, in the late 1930s, there was a backlash against this ideal, and so to revive and codify the cuisine of the different Soviet republics, the Ministry of the Food Industry, headed by Anastas Mikoyan, released an iconic cookbook in 1939 called Kniga o Kusnoy i Zdorovoy Pishche, or the Book of Tasty and Healthy Food. So naturally, I looked to that cookbook to find recipes from the period, but I found that many of the recipes use ingredients that wouldn't have been available to like 90% of the population. They definitely read more aspirational than actually achievable. But I did find one recipe for something called kasha, which is a sort of porridge. This version of it uses millet, which became the staple grain during World War II, and it uses an ingredient that people would have been able to grow at home, and that is pumpkin. Place peeled and finely chopped pumpkin in hot milk and cook for 10 to 15 minutes. Then add washed millet. Add salt and, stirring, continue cooking for another 15 to 20 minutes until thickened. Place the cooked porridge in a water bath or in the oven for 25 to 30 minutes. Now, versions of this dish are still made today in most of Eastern Europe, and with autumn right around the corner, it's the perfect dish for a crisp autumnal morning, something to warm your belly. And if you're looking to warm your feet, might I suggest a pair of socks from today's sponsor, Bombas. So if you haven't heard of Bombas, they are an amazing sock company. And they don't just sell socks, they also give them away. For every item that they sell, they donate one item. And to this day, they have donated over 100 million items to those in need. And it's not just socks, but underwear and t-shirts too. And those are the number 1, 2, and 3 most requested items at shelters. So everyone that gets donated is a good thing. And the socks are excellent. They're really, really comfortable, nice and soft. I got a pair that is specifically meant for running. Though I don't run, but I do walk a lot, and often I'll get chafed on the back of my ankle by the shoe. And so with these running socks, they have an extra little piece of fabric on the back so your ankles don't chafe. And Bombas has a 100% happiness guarantee. You can return or exchange them for free, no matter what, pretty much, even if your dog eats them. I don't have a dog, but maybe my cat would eat them. So feel good and do good with Bombas, knowing that your purchase will not only make your feet nice and comfy, but will also do some real good. And new customers get 20% off of their first purchase. Just go to bombas.com/tastinghistory and use my code TASTINGHISTORY20 at checkout. And now, let us make this kasha. for which you will need 1 cup or 220 grams of millet, 3 cups or 710 milliliters of whole milk, a pumpkin, and it being August, it turns out pumpkins are kind of hard to find at this time of year, so I am using a Japanese pumpkin, which absolutely works, and it will provide more than enough pumpkin because this recipe actually only calls for 500 grams. 1 teaspoon of sugar and a half teaspoon of salt. So first peel your pumpkin and then chop it into small pieces, a little less than an inch cubed. And again, you're looking for only 500 grams of the pumpkin after peeling and chopping. Then put the pumpkin in a pot and pour the milk over it, and then place the pot over a medium heat and bring it to a low simmer. Set the lid on and let it simmer for about 10 minutes. And as it simmers, you can wash your millet. And make sure to really rinse the millet until the water runs clear. It can take a little time, but then you can add it to the pot along with the salt and the sugar. And what's interesting about this recipe is that it doesn't actually say to put the sugar in there, but sugar is in the ingredient list, so I'm assuming that it goes in around now, but I could be wrong. It's not maybe the best written recipe. My recipes, on the other hand, are very well written. Those in the Tasting History Cookbook and the ones that I'm working on for the next Tasting History Cookbook. My Patreon patrons are already testing the recipes, so thank you to them. Now once you've added the millet, salt, and sugar, stir everything together and let it return to a low simmer, and then put the lid on and let it simmer for another 15 to 20 minutes as it starts to thicken up and the millet softens. Every few minutes, give it a stir, if for no other reason, to incorporate any milk that's starting to form a skin on top, but you want to be gentle because you don't want to break up the pumpkin. Now while it thickens, set your oven rack to the very bottom rung and preheat the oven to 275 Fahrenheit, 135 Celsius, and then when the millet has softened, set the pot with the lid on in the oven and let it bake for 25 minutes. Now with the milk and the sugar especially, this is definitely a dish that would have been made during the very best of times during World War II and during rationing, but I wanted to take a closer look at some of the not best of times. The Axis invasion of the Soviet Union, known as Operation Barbarossa, named after a Holy Roman Emperor and crusader from the 12th century, was the country's official introduction to World War II, known in the Soviet Union as the Great Patriotic War. But they actually entered the war somewhat battered already, both militarily, having sustained heavy casualties in the 1939 Winter War with Finland, and in a domestic sense. Between 1936 and 1938, Stalin led a terror campaign known as the Great Purge. And on top of that, the late 1930s saw several years of poor harvests, so when, within just a few months of the invasion, Germany came to control half of the Soviets' acreage used to grow grain, the Soviet government had to act lest their entire population would starve. And the starvation of the Soviet population was actually part of Germany's plan. See, in the months before the invasion, the German High Command realized that should they wish to press the war into Russia, the vast distances and the poor transportation in Soviet-controlled lands would eventually leave the German military, the Wehrmacht, stranded without food. Thus, it was determined that, one, the war can only be continued if the entire Wehrmacht is fed from Russia in the third year of the war, and two, if we take what we need out of the country, there can be no doubt that tens of millions of people will die of starvation. This was what would become known as Der Hungerplan, or the Hunger Plan, and it was overseen by Herbert Backe, who worked for the Reich Ministry of Food and Agriculture. And the plan called for all food that was made from Soviet lands to either be fed to the Wehrmacht or shipped all the way west to feed the German home front. And the plan partly worked. Many, many millions did die of starvation. But the food was not getting to the Wehrmacht or the German home front, because in the weeks after the invasion, Stalin decreed that all valuable property, including non-ferrous metals, grain, and fuel, which cannot be withdrawn, must without fail be destroyed. So as the Germans moved toward Moscow, they found pretty much nothing. It was all burnt up crops and destroyed farm implements. This was known as the scorched earth policy, which was the same policy that the Russians had employed on Napoleon when he invaded Russia 130 years earlier. Worked on him, and it would work on the Germans as well. It is an effective tactic, but unfortunately, it leaves a lot of people starving. So, a month after the invasion started, the Soviet citizens received their ration cards. Now, the U.S. had rationing, but it was set up very differently than in the Soviet Union. In the U.S., everybody got the same amount of food. You would get the same as the teacher down the street and as the president of the United States. In theory, he did follow rationing. But that's because, while food was scarce, there wasn't a huge sense that there was going to be any mass starvation. This was not the case in the Soviet Union. There already was mass starvation, even when it kind of began. So with famine definitely being in the cards, it really came down to just keeping as many people alive as possible. And so the way that they structured the rationing was more based on need. There were different categories. There were the workers, meaning people who did manual labor and hence needed more calories, and then there were white-collar employees who generally got fewer, then dependents and young children who needed the least. And your specific industry would also affect how many calories you got. Basically, the more important you were to the war effort, the more food you got. Now, with all of this variation, and a lot of variation throughout different periods of the war, it's hard to say, like, exactly how much anyone was getting. But on average, a person would get about a pound, maybe a little bit more, a pound of bread a day, and 3 to 4 pounds of meat per month. But while the central government was setting these rules, they often didn't have the manpower to kind of oversee them and make sure that everybody was getting what they needed. Their focus was the Red Army, who was fighting the Germans, getting them fed. And so the rationing to the people often fell to more local authorities. And there were a few ways that people would get fed. One was actually by growing victory gardens, things like vegetables, the pumpkin that we're making today, fruit, sometimes a little bit of livestock. Then there were the systems set up by the state. This was usually basics like canned meat, bread, and grain that would be distributed at shops and bakeries. And the government also had a system of stolovaya, or canteens, or cafeterias, which were government-run restaurants where, provided they had the food available, you could get an actual meal. But again, that's only if they had the food available. And there was often the question of, is there actually going to be food there? Because with half of the acreage of farming gone, they had trouble growing enough food for their population. And this is where the United States stepped in. Just as the U.S. had been providing food and equipment to Great Britain and China, the Soviets would benefit from something called the Lend-Lease Act. Passed in March of 1941, it was determined that supplying those countries fighting the Nazis and the Japanese was essential for the defense of the U.S. even before we were at war. In a November 1941 letter to FDR, Joseph Stalin wrote, "Your decision, Mr. President, to give the Soviet Union an interest-free credit of $1 billion in the form of material supplies and raw materials has been accepted by the Soviet government with heartfelt gratitude as urgent aid to the Soviet Union in its enormous and difficult fight against the common enemy, bloodthirsty Hitlerism." While much of the assistance was sent in the form of weapons and military supplies, the U.S. also sent 4.5 million tons of food overseas. One of the most iconic foods sent to the Soviet Union was pork, canned in the style that Russians were accustomed to. A very fatty canned pork called tushonka, which was canned by companies like Kroger Grocery and Baking Company, who produced it in Cincinnati, Ohio. This stuff was much loved and much hated. Much loved because during World War II, you were grateful to have anything to eat. Much hated because it lasted forever. As late as the 90s, people were still eating the tushonka from World War II. You can still get it today, but I don't think it's from World War II. Probably some cans still hanging around there. Maybe Steve MRE will eat it. I did get a can, modern can of it. Haven't tried it yet, but maybe I'll do that in like a separate video, if I can get up the gumption. But even with the U.S. trying to fill the gap between hunger and starvation, it usually wasn't enough because most of the food was going to feed the Red Army and not the civilian population. So people had to get creative with their cuisine. First to enter the diet were something called invented foods, and the government in 1943 started a campaign to get people to try these invented foods. Basically, they were foods that were created in a lab setting that would kind of be able to add certain nutrients to other foods. Like nastoi chvoi, which is a pine needle extract that delivered a lot of vitamin C. For extra protein, there was a yeast extract known as belkovye drozhi, which worked. It did add protein, but it also added a really bitter taste to whatever it went into, so it kind of ruined your soup or whatever. But, you know, need the protein. Now, these were foods that were created in a laboratory and kind of put on the people by the government. But individual people also had to come up with new food ideas, or old food ideas. One thing that they looked to was the gulag. Now, those who found themselves in these horrific prisons were prone to starvation even when the country wasn't at war. And so the prisoners, or whoever was running the gulag, often had to come up with dishes that used but the meagerest of ingredients. And one of these was a sort of stew called balanda, which a former inmate described as soup made of flounder, which comes straight from the barrel and is boiled up, guts and all, with salt. Then red cabbage is added in, and you have your gruel. It's unbelievably bitter. You wouldn't be able to eat it, but we did, because there was nothing else. And so this soup that was once relegated to the gulags of Russia was now being served on the tables of Russia to the average person. And it was usually made with kind of leftover ingredients that you really should probably toss away, like horse bone or herring tail, things like that. Then it would be thickened with millet, most often, which is what we're using today, or rusks that are broken up. And rusks are like hardtack. Another food with very little nutritional value was something called shroti. And this was when they would take either linseed or some other seed like hemp seed, and they would make oil out of it. And then the hulls that were left, which would usually be tossed or given to animals as fodder, were made into cakes and cooked. And this is what they would eat in the very, very worst of times, like in Leningrad. In September of 1941, the German army advanced from the south, while the Finnish army invaded from the north to almost encircle the city of Leningrad, a city of nearly 3 million people. They blockaded the city and lay siege for 872 days. There was one route in and out of the city via Lake Ladoga, a route that would become known as the Road of Life. Now, eventually, many people would be evacuated out on this road and food would be brought in, but it wasn't an option in that first winter. So by November of that first year, the ration for workers had dropped to only 250 grams of bread, and for dependents and children, 150 grams. That's like three slices of bread a day. And since this was a city and the war had just begun, nobody had planted any victory gardens and there was no farmland. And so, as the Leningrad Food Commissioner, Dmitry Pavlov, said, the sole means of receiving food was through the ration card. This, of course, led to counterfeiting ration cards and the theft of ration cards, as well as just a black market. But most of the population, they relied on what was known as the line. These were lines that stretched outside of bakeries and shops that were giving out the rationed food. In their diaries, many people likened them to snakes or tapeworms wending their ways through the streets. And the first thing you did when you woke up in the morning was you got in line. Where gripped by one all-consuming passion, they hardly uttered a word. With manic impatience, they stared ahead over the next man's shoulder at the bread. An old woman waiting for bread slowly slides to the ground, but no one cares. She is dead, or she will be trampled nevertheless. Those waiting tilt their heads to see if her ration card has fallen on the ground. Perhaps it is still tightly clutched in her bony hand. What's worse is that for many of these people waiting, there would be no bread at the end of the line, because by 10 or 11 in the morning, the shop would be empty. People would try to coax other people out of line, telling them that another bakery or shop had just gotten a fresh delivery and they should go into that line. Or they would fake air raid sirens to try to get people to scatter for cover. Many people were reduced to eating clover and wallpaper paste, pine needles, rats, animals out on the streets, or others who had already died. And when a family member died, they would often try to keep it hidden because then they could use their ration card for at least a couple more days. That is how the majority of the population in Leningrad had to survive. But there were those who were more fortunate or less scrupulous. One girl in her diary recalled, "I didn't go hungry. My father works in Leningrad supply. During the blockade, we ate better than before the war. We had everything." At the party headquarters at Smolny in Leningrad, it was said that they were eating cake while the people outside were starving, very French Revolution-like. "Yes, only under the Bolsheviks, only under Soviet power, is it possible to have such rest under the conditions of war, of a prolonged siege of a city. What could be better? We eat, drink, stroll about, sleep, or we simply have nothing to do." While at the same exact time, just outside the doors, 2,000 to 3,000 people every day were dying of starvation. Now, Leningrad is an outlier. It really is the worst situation for the Soviet people, for the home front at least. But the rest of the country was going through periods of famine throughout the war, especially because in the early 40s, pretty much every harvest was below average, even considering that they had lost half of their harvesting lands. So most people were dependent on the foods that they were growing themselves, things like potatoes, beets, and pumpkins, like the ones that we are using in the kasha, which should be about ready. So once the kasha has baked for 25 minutes, remove the pot from the oven and dish it up. And here we are, millet and pumpkin kasha from the Soviet home front. It's actually a really pretty color. I mean, it's like vibrantly colored. I was not expecting that. Let me get a little bit of everything on here. You definitely smell the pumpkin. That is the smell you're getting. I don't really know what millet smells like. It's kind of plain, I guess. Here we go. That's actually pretty good. I mean, I would add more like sugar or something like that, but the pumpkin is sweet, and so you do get the flavor of the pumpkin. That is what kind of shines through. But then you get this other flavor, which I'm guessing is the millet, that is a little bit more earthy, and I don't know. I kind of like it. It reminds me a lot of like couscous, the flavor of couscous, and the look a little bit, but like the flavor of couscous, but pumpkin flavored. Also, the great thing about this is I can tell it is going to be very, very filling. I made a big bowl. There's no way I'm going to be able to eat all of this in one sitting. Think more like oatmeal. How much oatmeal you could have in a bowl? Not that much. That's how much you would want. It's going to be really filling, which would be good when you are being rationed. Also, if you do want it a little bit richer, you can go ahead and add some butter, because there is a Russian saying that says you can't spoil kasha with butter. And frankly, I don't think you can spoil anything with butter, but so you can add more butter on top of this or during the cooking process. There are even some recipes in the cookbook from today that mention adding butter at the end. So go ahead and add some butter if you want, and I will see you next time on Tasting History.